from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Jennifer has a 9-year-old who has autism and cerebral palsy. Shannon has a 9-year-old, too, also with autism. And Sarah has a teenager who's deaf and autistic. All have contributed to a new book called My Baby Rides the Short Bus, The Unabashedly Human Experience of Raising Kids with Disabilities. In the hour ahead, we'll talk with all three parents about why they wanted to create this book. And we want to hear from you as well about raising kids with disabilities. That's our topic, ahead on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome to Forum. When I realized my son Leo had autism, Shannon DeRocheRosa writes in her blog, I had a visual epiphany similar to the wide-eyed new parent who suddenly sees babies everywhere, except I saw short buses. Short buses, the kind that take kids like my autistic son to and from school every day. They're everywhere. And if you don't believe me, take a tally the next time you drive around any reasonably sized town. My Baby Rides the Short Bus, The Unabashedly Human Experience of Raising Kids with Disabilities, is a new collection of essays written by parents of disabled children. The stories talk about the challenges of finding schools, finding help, and just finding time, about feeling alone and then realizing that you're not. They're about both determination and sometimes devastation, about all that's involved in raising kids with special needs. Joining us this morning on Forum are three contributors to that book. Shannon DeRocheRosa also writes the blog The Adventures of Lilo and His Potty Mouth Mom. Shannon, good morning.
Morning.
Joining us, too, is Jennifer Bide-Meyer. She's also a writer who, along with Shannon Rosa, also manages the book and blog project Can I Sit With You? Jennifer, good morning.
Good morning.
And in a moment, we'll also be joined by Sarah Talbot. She's one of the editors of the book My Baby Rides the Short Bus. She's also an assistant principal at a high school in Seattle, and she'll be joining us just in a moment by telephone. I'd like to begin by asking you each to describe your child. Jennifer, first, please.
Yeah, I have two children. Jack is my special needs kid. He's 9 and a half, and he has autism and cerebral palsy ataxia, which means he kind of walks like a drunk. He also has a bit of a panic disorder, and he's had really difficult sleep issues that we are now managing over time and experience and medication.
And why did you want to contribute an essay to this book?
Well, I think that there's well, first of all, any time that there's something interesting that I can participate in and use my skills towards my son's advocacy, I try to do that. But I think there aren't a lot of safe places where parents with special needs kids can be very real. There's a lot of expectations that we're perfect and that we're such great moms. And so to be a part of a book like this where it's really, these are real stories about real families, and there's not a lot of sugarcoating, and that's the life that we really lead. Not to say that everything's horrible all the time, but to participate in something where there was, they were asking for honesty and not asking for me to be really, really thankful all the time, because while I am thankful for my child, it's a hard life.
Shannon, was that something that motivated you as well, this sense that most of what's written is also something that feels a bit too much like cheerleading and support and rah-rah when life's different than that?
Well, as a former cheerleader, I must say that I'm all for cheerleading. But no, I just really appreciate books that are, like Jennifer said, that are about real experiences and not just about the way our lives unfold individually, but about the ways that we are actually not isolated from each other, because parenting a child with special needs can be extremely isolating. And when you hear other voices from other people who are in a similar situation or different situations, but there are so many shared touchstones, it helps me. And I just wanted to be some part of something that could really help other people too, help inspire them, help reach out to the community, give them tools to, you know, advocate for their children, and just help people feel less alone.
You, in your essay that you contributed to this book, you write actually about Jennifer.
Yes, I do.
And you talk about this question of feeling alone mm-hmm. and feeling like there isn't someone else who really understands. And then you had this experience with meeting Jennifer, and you write, my heart grew 3 sizes. I lost my grump. Yes. I latched onto her, and I've yet to let go.
Well, yeah, she's my perennial partner in crime, definitely. I mean, I wish everybody was as lucky as I am to find a Jennifer in their lives, but I think that a lot of people do. They're not necessarily fortunate enough to have their Jennifers right there in their own town, but in online forums and special needs boards and blogs. And I actually am the parenting special needs editor for a site called blogher.com that generates this kind of community and points people in that direction. It's fortunate.
Shannon DeRocheRosa joins us this hour. She's part of this new book called My Baby Rides the Short Bus. She joins us along with Jennifer Bide-Myers, who also contributed an essay to the book, and Sarah Talbot, who's one of the editors of the book, along with Yantra Bertelli and Jennifer Silverman. She's also an assistant principal at a high school in Seattle and is on her way down to the Bay Area for a couple of events that we'll talk about in just a bit. But Sarah Talbot, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Would you begin, if you would please, by telling us something about your son, about Caleb.
Okay. Caleb is 15. He is funny and cute and redheaded, and he is deaf, and he has autism. He also has a complicated pattern of medical disabilities that impact his ability to get along in the day and make our lives kind of complicated as well.
And you write in your essay about the impact, in part, that this has on your entire family, because you have 4 other children. Is that right?
We have 3 other children and a foster daughter in our house right now.
And so describe for us the way in which that all interacts together and the impact that it has on the larger family.
Well, what I wrote about in my essay, and I think what's sort of forefront in my mind right now, is the impact that bringing outside agencies and outside people into our home has on our family. I think that, I was just driving down here from Seattle and talking to my daughter about how she feels about having 5 hours of extra supervision in the house a day. We have a stranger in our house at least 5 hours a day caring for Caleb. And it means that at 13, she can't have a crazy fit without being embarrassed about her behavior. And I think 13-year-olds should be able to have fits.
Yeah. As anyone who's ever had a 13-year-old knows. Yeah.
So I think that the extra pressure on my kids to behave appropriately, as if they were in a public space while they're at home, puts a lot of strain on our relationships, and it puts a lot of strain on them as people to be sort of better than everybody around them. And I think that's one of the biggest, we talk about isolation a lot as parents of disabled kids, but there's also, as a parent of a disabled child, you simply have to be more patient, a better advocate, better at all of the things that you have to do as a parent. You just have to be. And it's not that, I ever chose to be a disability advocate or ever chose to be really good at dealing with agencies. I didn't want to learn that in my life. And my kids didn't want to learn how to behave themselves all the time, but that's sort of what the situation called for. So, you have to step up a little more, and it feels unfair a lot, I think.
Sarah Talbot is one of the editors of the new book, My Baby Rides the Short Bus, The Unabashedly Human Experience of Raising Kids with Disabilities. In a sense, it part of what Sarah says, it sounds like, Jennifer, is that you have to be, or you're expected to be, at your best 24/7.
All the time, always. And it's people really mean well, because they say things like, oh, you're such a great mom. And I'm thinking, you don't know who I am. You have no idea whether the kid's still alive. That automatically means I'm a great mom. And I hope I'm a great mom. I hope I rise to the occasion. But there is a feeling of needing to have everything taken care of all the time. And part of that is the truth, because I feel like in our lives, things fall apart so much faster. We don't have a lot of room for error because, especially with a child with autism, and I have a toddler who's, you know, she's a very bright little girl, but she's got her own needs. So if something falls apart, it all falls apart so quickly. So there's an external pressure and there's also an internal pressure. I always have a full set of clothes and extra this and extra that. And people laugh because my minivan looks like we're going on a caravan. And then there's constantly, not only is there the backup plan, but there's the other backup plan. And thank God we have great community because when something fails, there are a couple people I can call to help step in. But everything is urgent all the time.
What about this question of the people, as Sarah Talbot was saying, Shannon, that everyone has an opinion about you? Not only do you have to be at your best, but there always are people sort of observing, whether it's actually literally, in mm-hmm. Sarah's case, bringing help into the house all the time. But wherever you are, people have an opinion.
Yeah, well, you know, I actually kind of voluntarily expose myself to that. I blog about our lives on both on Blogger and on my personal site because I feel it's important to share this. You know, I feel it's important to be honest so that nobody feels like they have to be this perfect mom, so they can see that, you know, I actually did fail. You know what? I forgot to bring back a pair of my son's shoes to pick him up from school. He had stepped in a puddle. He didn't have his shoes. He completely lost it for the afternoon. We couldn't take my daughter to her dance class. You know, things like this happen, and I go and I either tweet about it or I blog about it, and people write in and they say, oh my God, you know, the same thing happened to me. And it makes it easier for when we are less than perfect. I really don't want to live up to this expectation of having to be a perfect mom because, like Sarah said, I didn't choose this. Mm-hmm. And I'm good at it, but I didn't choose this. And, you know,
Let me ask you about some of the specific challenges that you face with the conditions that you have to contend with. One of the things that you write about in your essay, Jennifer, is about getting help because you can't be on 24/7 or be without that you need assistance, but that it's really hard to find. You talk about sort of even looking on Craigslist at one point.
It's exhausting.
And who you're looking for. And you write at the end of your essay, I'm looking for a kind and gentle-mannered caretaker who thrives on working with a kid who cannot load his own fork, wipe his own face, or use the toilet on a regular basis. I'm never going to find that aide because that person doesn't exist. I'm not even that person.
Sorry, a little bit clumped. It's really hard because you have to find someone. First of all, we didn't choose this life. We didn't choose it. And so to grow and enough skills to be able to do it yourself is a huge mountain to climb. And then you realize that if you don't take care of yourself and get some help, you're going to lose it. And if I can't hold up all those plates all the time. So when I'm not there, I want someone to be me. And when I am there, I want there to be two of us so we can get something done. So there's not stuff everywhere because my particular child creates quite a lot of mess. He's like a what's that little messy kid on the Peanuts cartoon? He's precious, but he doesn't have good fine motor skills. So half of his food ends up on the floor unless you're right there, and then he loses his independence. But finding someone that you can trust, finding someone that has enough skill, finding someone that's not going to judge you because it's impossible to keep the house clean, finding someone that's going to trust that you're a good parent and not call you into Child Protective Services, because we are all so connected in these systems that it only takes two more clicks between social worker and Child Protective Services. And we have social workers coming into our house, most of us, several times a year. So there's this constant pressure. But it's you can't just find a babysitter and then say, oh, P.S., my kid has autism. He might escape out the dog door and end up covered in dog poop because he'll go out on the side yard. And we're a little afraid he might jump over the front fence. And, oh, make sure the back gate's locked because he sneaks out and we don't know where he'd go and he's nonverbal. Mm. So there's no the list of the criteria that you are looking for in a person who can watch your children is so long.
How much harder is it as kids get older? You were talking about food winding up on the floor. You know, that's okay if a kid is two.
Right.
Your kids are nine, and Sarah, yours is now a teenager. How much more challenging, Shannon, does this become when you're, it's not your 2-year-old who's making a mess. It's your 9-year-old, your 10-year-old, your teenager.
It is, you know, I feel kind of fortunate in that we have not had a whole lot of negative reactions, you know, out in public. But it is, the thing is, the expectation is that you have this darling child, this sweet child who you love with all your heart. And when they're little, it's okay. Like you said, you know, people go out, they're like, oh, well, they're misbehaving. They're creating this mess. It's all they're little. But yeah, as they get bigger, people's expectations change and your expectations change. And you realize that, you know, you have to readjust. It's kind of an ongoing, it's not quite a grieving process. I mean, it is for somebody, but it's hard. But the thing is, we have a lot of good role models ahead of us. We have Sarah Talbot, you know, who has a teenager. There are people like Ann Bauer, who has an adult son with autism, who writes about him sometimes on Salon. And there are so many great role models, both in the real world, like Susan Senator, who also writes about her adult son, Nat, who has autism in a similar way to my son. And so we have these role models, so we can see what's coming up. There are other people out there who have lived this life before, and that helps me.
Sarah Talbot, tell me something about what you want from the rest of us. We talked earlier about how, besides helping, but we talked some about what it's like to have sort of everyone have an opinion and people in your lives all the times. But, you know, when there is that difficult situation, when you're out with your 15-year-old and something happens, do you want people to engage? Do you want people to look the other way? If you want them to engage, how do you engage?
It's interesting. I don't know that I have an answer for how other people should act around my son. I had a care provider take my son out into the community. He threw a raging fit at Safeway. He's a big guy. He's 15. Threw himself on the ground, and she couldn't get him up. She couldn't get him out of the store. And several people sort of stood around and stared at him. That's not helpful, I guess. So the one thing I would, you know, say don't do is just stand there and stare, you know, either engage or disengage, but don't get stuck halfway. Eventually, the manager of the store actually came down and helped her lift him up and move him out of the store, which was incredibly kind. It might have seemed to some people watching that event that it was an unkind thing to do, because the manager was essentially, like, kicking them out, but it was very helpful to that person, to my care provider in that moment. And I think that asking questions, engaging with a person, and if you're willing to and interested in it, saying, how can I help you, is a really great way to start. But disengaging is okay. It's okay to just walk away and not engage and try to help if you feel like that wouldn't be comfortable to you or that might be overwhelming. And, you know, when I talk about people in my house always having an opinion, I expect them to have an opinion because they're people. And so I can't ask people to not care about the work enough to have an opinion about how we do it as parents. I think that would be inhuman.
Jennifer, what would you add to what you'd like from people? You know, when you're at your favorite coffee place and you have a difficult moment with your 9-year-old, what do you want?
Well, you know, one of the things we're teaching our younger daughter is the you may either stare or say hello, but you may not stare. You can either look away or you can say hello, but you can't just stand there and stare because people stare at us. And I think that not engaging part is really painful for me, because I'd rather have someone say, "What can I? Is there anything I can do to help you?"
Yeah.
Or smile, or do something. But to look at us like they're going to catch something from us, I think is really awful. And in general, in the world, I know I do a lot of interpretation. People say things and they mean it well, but it comes across really badly.
Like what?
Well, like you're so blessed. Jack is your special gift from God, and I'm like, okay, well, so's Katie, but what makes this a, did I win a prize? Like, what are you trying to say? I think there's a constant sort of, people don't know what to say. Yeah. What they kind of are saying is, oh my God, your life is really hard, and I'm so glad that's not me. and that actually would be fine.
That would be a better thing to say.
That'd be fine for me. Yeah. But yeah. I think when we're in public, I know when I see something happening, I have a first response, which is, oh, look at that parent not parenting their child. And then I think, even I do this, I think, wait a minute, I have no idea what's happening there. It's entirely possible that she's used every parenting skill she has or he has, and that child has whatever disability.
Shannon DeRosa, what would you add?
I was just thinking back to actually, we had a complete meltdown in Costco in March that just, I had an enormous basket full of, I'd gone shopping for some kind of SEPTAR event for our special ed PTA. I had like, you know, every apple in the store. I had my 5-year-old, I had my 11-year-old, my son just completely lost it. And I was stuck. There was nothing I could do, nowhere I could go. And nobody helped me. And like, I would agree with Jennifer, I just, you know, either help me or don't help me, but don't stare and don't make me feel like I'm some kind of freak show. You know, that's the worst part, is having people look at you as though there's something they wish they didn't have to see.
Shannon DeRosa is one of the contributors to a new book called My Baby Rides the Short Bus, The Unabashedly Human Experience of Raising Kids with Disabilities. They're going to be reading tonight, by the way, at the Modern Times Bookstore at Valencia and 20th Street in San Francisco. That's tonight at 7 o'clock, Modern Times Bookstore, Valencia and 20th in the city. And then tomorrow they'll be at the Pegasus Bookstore, also at 7 o'clock in Berkeley, if you'd like to hear them or if you want to be part of this overall discussion. We're going to open up our phone lines in just a moment, and we welcome your participation in this conversation, too, about what your own experiences perhaps have been with raising disabled kids, what you'd like from society, not just on an individual basis when the meltdown happens in Costco, but what you want the rest of society to be able to do to respond. We'll go up and go ahead and give the phone number now and start to taking your calls in just a second. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. If you want to email us your thoughts, it's forum at kqed.org. That's forum at kqed.org. Sarah, I want to read something from your essay as well, because it's a very striking beginning, and then have you comment on it. Your essay begins like this. The institution has two large social rooms, two kitchens, and 5 bedrooms. Staff members rotate in and out throughout the day. The morning shift starts at 6 and prepares breakfast, then sets up visual schedules. Often there's a midday lull when the residents go to day programs. One resident, Caleb, has the most intensive needs. He's been returned to the institution by the police several times. You refer to and describe the institution, and the institution's your house, right?
I live in a crazy house sometimes. I guess the moment that I wrote that was the beginning of this transition in our lives where we needed to bring more intensive services in to care for Caleb because we couldn't do it anymore, both physically and emotionally, and we couldn't keep our jobs and do because of the amount of work involved. And it's so overwhelming to have, in a month, we had 3 different psychologists come out to evaluate Caleb at our house and to talk to us about what our needs were.
And Sarah, I'm sorry to interject, but we're almost to a break. So I want to come back after the break and have you describe more what your house, what all of your houses are like and how we can respond as a society to families with special needs kids. Here's the number if you want to join our conversation, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us your thoughts at forum at kqed.org. Back with more in just a moment. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guests this hour are all contributors to a fascinating new book called My Baby Rides the Short Bus, The Unabashedly Human Experience of Raising Kids with Disability. Sarah Talbot is one of the editors of the book. She joins us along with Jennifer Bide-Myers and Shannon DeRosa, who also contributed essays to the book. Before the break, Sarah, and here's our number, by the way. We'll get to your calls. Lots of calls coming in. We'll get to them in just a moment. 866-733-6786 is the number, 866-733-6786. But Sarah, before the break, you were just describing your home and the decision to bring in more help because you realized you just could not do it anymore in a way that began to make your house in some ways become a sort of institution. Is that one of the tougher moments to come to when you realize I can't do this alone?
2 years ago at the beginning of the school year, we went through probably 6 care providers in about a month. They all quit. And it became clear to us that one of us was going to have to quit our jobs, or we were going to have to put Caleb in an institution, or something was going to have to change from the help in terms of the help we got from state agencies. We couldn't quit our jobs because we wouldn't be able to keep our home, and we have several other children who need to live there. So it just became this feeling of being trapped in an impossible place. And when our case manager said, you know, I can move you up a level in terms of the intensity of the care you need, and we can provide some more intensive services, it really did feel like so lucky and such a great thing to happen to our family, because it meant we got to keep Caleb at home.
Yeah.
And then the invasion came, and the agency that we work with sends 5 or 6 different people to work with Caleb, a different person every night, pretty much. So all of these different people have personalities and lives, and we need to get to know them, and they are interacting with our other children, and so there's just a lot of relationship to establish there. And
there's a lot of resource need, which, of course, brings up the question of money. It costs a lot to be able to support this. And this also brings, I guess, a question I wanted to pose. And Shannon Theroux-Schorza, maybe you can start us out on this, and then I promise I'll get to our questions. But on what society's responsibility is, we live in a state at a time of immense problems and lack of resources. You couldn't have a state, probably, with more problems than California has at the moment. How do you get yourself to the front of that line? How would you convince people listening to this program that this is something that cannot be ignored, despite all the other problems that California has?
Okay, well, first, the way to get yourself to the front of the line is to have your son take out the social worker, which is what worked for us.
That's not funny, but it's funny, of course.
The other thing is that I put on my political hat. The thing that society can do is to fully fund IDA for our kids.
IDA.
Mm-hmm. It's the which I'm now.
Individuals
with Disabilities Education Act. I'm sorry. It's partially funded. It's not fully funded. It guarantees all of our children a free and appropriate education, the same as any other child. And that's something you can write into your rep. You can write to, if you're in California, you can write to Senators Buckster and Feinstein and tell them to fully fund IDA. So our kids, the money is there, you know, as far as education goes. As far as the rest of it goes, from the California funding of that's something we all fight for every day, because we all know, everybody, Sarah knows, Jen knows, we all know that our kids have us as their advocates. Our kids are the lucky ones. There are a lot of kids out there who are not as lucky as our kids. So if we fight for the state funding, then we can take care of all these.
You know, At one point I went to Golden Gate Regional Center is the center that helps divvy up some of those funds. And those people work really hard to try and get people taken care of, but they, you know, their hands are constantly tied and the pots are always empty. But at one point I was trying to explain that if we don't get respite care, meaning subsidized, because of course it doesn't pay for a full babysitter, but it pays for some of the babysitter. If we don't get respite care, then those stay-at-home parents will not be able to function properly. And then they're going to have a bigger crisis on their hand, because then my marriage isn't going to succeed. And then that marriage is going to fall apart. And then you've got 2 houses you have to support. And if it gets really bad, then you have a mental health crisis. And then you have a child that's going to need to go in a home. And it's like this,
pay now, perhaps, or pay later.
Exactly. Perhaps it's the spot, the worst case scenario. Yeah. But
it's,
I think that's how it
education.
Goes, that you really have to take care of it at some point so that the rest of it can stay together.
And to our callers, let's go to Becky first, who joins us from Sonoma this morning. Becky, go ahead.
Oh, hello.
Hello.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
I have autistic twins. Okay. And I'm constantly running into red tape. Constantly. And it's very disheartening. I give up. It took me a couple of years to get respite care. I finally got... what do they call it? Protective supervision for one of my sons in IHSS. The other one, he didn't quite qualify. And the problems I run into are they go after one another when they get frustrated. And out in public, people just stare at us. And I'm always finding myself trying to qualify us. You know, they have autism. They don't know better.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, some people are understanding, and some people just stare. And as for, like, the state help, I'm grateful for what I have. But I feel like we need so much more. Like,
Becky,
I'm having a...
Sorry to interject, Becky. Thank you for telling your story. Stay with us for a moment, but I want to get some response to the situation you describe and see if one of our guests has some thoughts on that. Jennifer?
Oh, I just think that it's anytime you – it's not like adding a second child. It's like it's a multiplier. It's – I mean, you should see the birthday parties even when we get the kids together. It's not just – they sort of amplify each other, and I think that I've heard this before when people have two children with special needs. It's almost like people, when they go to get their resources, they're like, oh, well, you already get this. Well, it's they have two whole children who need help. And I think it's very hard to coordinate. You know, she's talking about multiple different agencies coordinating some of those things. And it's just a lot of paperwork and it's a lot of, you know, following up and phone calls. And I don't think that there's – the good news is it sounds like you have your hand into every agency, but –
What's the attributes you need most to pull this off,
coffee.
To contend?
Coffee. Because you're not going to get sleep.
Yeah.
And drama.
Yeah.
I think that one of the – there's a benefit to being able to say, look, yesterday I felt like I was going to lose it with my child and I didn't have anybody to call. And I don't know what is going to happen if my child doesn't back off when I get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's coming soon.
Right.
Or my child's getting bigger than me. Or look at the bruise my child caused on my other child.
Yeah. So it's not a time to be shy, no. reticent, no. and to smooth things over.
No.
One of the quickest responses I got from, and this is about, you know, getting health care, but one of the quickest responses I got from a place, from a neurology clinic that was booked for, you know, 2.5 years or whatever, was when I called and I said, my son has broken my nose and he has bit through both of his wrists. So I'm not quite sure what we can do to get him in. And I had a phone call and an appointment the next morning
yeah.
with all of the people that they needed to see. So, yeah, the drama is very important.
Catherine in San Francisco has our next observation or comment. Catherine, go ahead.
Hi. I'm the parent of two children, single parent of two children, one of whom is Sam. He's 23 years old now. He's severely disabled with multiple disabilities, but he's also a very charming, engaging, energetic young man who has not only enriched my life, but enriched everybody's lives who he touches, including his sister. And I wanted to comment when you said that your 13-year-old doesn't feel like she can express herself. My daughter never had that problem whatsoever in front of anybody expressing herself, and she's now a very healthy 21-year-old senior at a college in Southern California and a very happy and productive young woman. But I wanted to say that, you know, it doesn't get easier. It doesn't get better.
Mm-hmm.
You have to foster that sense of humor. You have to foster that strength and that advocacy skills that you developed when they, as they age, mm-hmm. when they are a baby till now. There is nothing out there in San Francisco for these children once they leave high school. The
Catherine,
problems are very limited.
Yeah, Catherine, thank you. Shannon, I want to go to you because when Catherine said it doesn't get easier, I saw you go, oh, no!
I know that. I just, you know, it's different knowing it and hearing somebody say it outright. But I am, again, always grateful for the role models who go before us and show us the way. I do want to get back to what just Becky was saying about how isolated she felt and how alone she felt. I just wanted to make sure people know that this area, the Bay Area specifically, has a lot of really great resources for parents of kids with special needs to build community. There are many Yahoo groups. There are a lot of kind of nascent and existent special ed PTAs. There's a lot of groups. So if she feels like she needs help, I would feel she could reach out to us through the websites that you cited initially.
And in the book, My Baby Rides the Short Bus, The Unabashedly Human Experience of Raising Kids with Disabilities, you list in the back a fair number of resources. Mm-hmm. They're biographies of each of you and, mm-hmm. and tells about your various blogs mm-hmm. and sites that, that people can get to. Mm-hmm. And again, our authors will be reading from their book tonight, Modern Times Bookstore, Valencia, 20th and City, tomorrow at Pegasus Bookstore in Berkeley at 7 o'clock. An emailer wants to know which Pegasus Bookstore. I guess there are two. We'll try to – do you know which one, Jennifer?
It was, downtown. I thought that was the –
All right. We'll see if we can find out.
If they go to my site, squidlicious.com, the top post lists every single detail of every single event.
A couple of emailers have questions. My son has been exposed to a few special needs children, and he's partially fascinated and at the same time terrified. Mm-hmm. How do you suggest we introduce our children to this part of our society?
Oh, you're already such a great person. That whoever wrote that, that is like an amazing, awesome person. Thank you for caring enough to want to offer that gift to your child. I think, it would help if you could find a family with a family with special needs kid who was open, because one of the things I love most is when a kid asks, "Why doesn't Jack talk?" And so I can have that conversation, and even if the parent is uncomfortable, the kid just wants to know. Yeah. So I think that anytime a child has a question, if you can approach that parent and see if – even asking the parent, are you comfortable explaining your child's disability to my son? He's very interested. I know, because I've had that situation before, and I just feel like it is such a gift to be able to help another family learn.
A couple of other emailed questions, and we'll get back to our calls. Karen writes, have any fathers contributed to the book? Do you have fathers present in your children's lives? Sarah, can you comment on that as one of the editors of the book? Sarah, are you with us? May have lost Sarah. Shannon, are there fathers in this book?
And our husbands, both of our husbands, are incredible dads.
Yeah.
You know, we actually we are so fortunate that we actually bailed last weekend. Jennifer and I and another friend of ours, we took off for the weekend because we had just lost it. Jennifer was recovering from pneumonia. I was completely overworked, overwhelmed. We have no problem. We can leave our children, our challenging children, all five of them, with our husbands. And we can leave for the weekend. We're that lucky. Our husbands are amazing.
Yeah. I think I know I chose well at this point.
Yeah.
I have.
But we haven't talked about this, and you don't have to talk about it, but there have to be incredible stresses on
the
marriage as
well. Oh, yeah.
There
were a good couple of years when we were just really good roommates. And that was fine, because at least, you know, we stayed together and we were good roommates. And there have been some very painful things trying to – because we each come to this with our own family. How do we get through crises? So luckily, Sean and I just kind of made a decision that we were going to stay together and be a team. And I think that that was the best choice that we made.
Mm-hmm. Here's a person who wants to know about what to do for those of us, as he puts it, in the middle. My wife and I can relate to what your guests are talking about. Our lives take a lot of planning. However, we have a slightly different issue. Our preteen daughter was diagnosed with pervasive development disorder. Mm-hmm. Our problem has been finding help for our daughter since she never fit the autism level. Are there resources or ideas for those of us in the middle? It's one of the things about autism, because it really includes A to
right.
Z.
Yeah, right. PDD-NOS is what the acronym is for that. It's one of those, they call them invisible disabilities. And I often sometimes think that that's even harder, because people don't take your child's disability seriously.
Or they see the child and think, well, he or she should be doing fine.
Exactly. Right. So this is another situation in which I would encourage people to reach out to the blogosphere. There are a lot of parents that write about this. There are a lot of parents who can encourage you, and again, role models who can show you what they've done.
And we have the special ed PTA that we helped found down in Redwood City, SEPTAR.org. In that group, I actually think we have quite a few families whose mm-hmm. kids have that diagnosis. And, you know, those children, as they are starting to get older, they're having their own issues about trying to determine where they fit in the special needs world. Do they still keep going to our jumpy house things? Do they want to hang out with all those special needs kids
as they
fit in and don't fit in?
And let's get another caller engaged. Carrie in Santa Rosa joins us next. Carrie, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to mention a special program through Sonoma State University. It's called the Collaborative Autism Training and Support Program, CATS. And it trains students to go into the house and work with your autistic child. And what's great about this is they're particularly sensitive. And they're better than any other child care worker you're going to find.
Carrie, thank you. And this is at Sonoma State.
Sonoma State. And you can email lorna.catford@sonoma.edu for more information. And, you know, there's so much to say about all of this. But it certainly saved my marriage. And it was a godsend.
Carrie, thanks. Thanks for the call and for the suggestion for getting help for families in this particular situation. Leanne in Santa Rosa joins us next. Leanne, go ahead.
The other end of the spectrum, my mother was a sped teacher my entire life. So I grew up, we had no special needs kids in our house, but we grew up around them all the time. And I have a great story about my brother in high school. Came home and he was so ticked that this girl kept beating him in typing class. And he was like, he couldn't let it go. And we went to his graduation and he pointed her out and she didn't have arms. And he never said that to us. Like, he never said she was typing with her feet. My mom looked at us and she's like, I'm so proud of you guys that that wasn't even an issue.
That's a great story.
Yeah, it was just so funny that, you know, and we're the type of family that if we would see the happenings in the stores, we'd come up.
Yeah.
Leanne, thanks. That's a great story. And there is Sarah Talbot. If you're back with us, humor is part of this, and there's humor in this book. Talk about that some about why it's important and how you managed to hold on to it.
That was a delicate balance with the humor. We had a couple of moments where we had to make some edits to the cover, and we really need humor, and I think that the way that Jennifer Silverman, Yantra Bertelli, and I came together was around sort of a socially unacceptable sense of humor about our children. the title to the book was an idea for a T-shirt. You know, we were planning to make shirts for people who stare at us. What, you know, your baby is in the honor roll, but mine rides the short bus kind of thing. And I think that sometimes that humor can really offend people. So we tried in this book to really help people grow the humor in their stories and express it really delicately. And I think people did, the writers are just fantastic and did a really good job talking about, you know, parenting is funny. And I got to tell you, there's not much funnier than my son. He's a funny, funny guy. And many times he intends to be funny. He has a good sense of humor, which is odd for an autistic kid. But it's just vital to staying alive to keep a sense of humor about it.
Linda writes in, I want to join into the discussion. My son is 16, autistic, and capable of getting upset and hurting people, especially when out in the community. We've had two experiences where the police were called, put my son during a tantrum in handcuffs, and took him off to a psychiatric facility. The introduction of the book, as I recall, begins with saying, oh, the police are in my driveway again. It's a reality of having to contend with that part of life as well.
It certainly is. My son's been brought home by police officers four or five times in his life. and it's a little bit upsetting, that part of it.
Sally writes in, Dear fellow travelers, glad to see that I cannot get through because the phone is flooded with callers. Thanks for your irreverence and vulnerability. I just ordered the book as I listened and look forward to reading it.
Thank you.
I'm a single mom of a 19-year-old autistic spectrum young daughter. I echo your words and experience. Sally, hang in there. Wendy in Menlo Park joins us next. Wendy, go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you so much for raising this topic. So I am the mom of a 21-year-old autistic spectrum son who's doing pretty well right now. But going back to his transition to middle school, we had a horrific time because the school district didn't take it upon themselves to really welcome him into the middle school. As a result, he had a total meltdown. No one understood his disability. We ended up having to sue the school, and the good news is he got placed into the right setting.
Wendy, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to hold you because there's a funny problem with your phone connection and the clicking, but you raise a really important issue. So if you don't mind, let me just try to get some reaction to it. There's one of the essays I read in the book last night was about the whole problem of finding schools. Mm-hmm. And I think probably many of us think that because of the Americans for Disabilities Act that everything's accessible. And this
here's a cake.
You're laughing at me. And it's far from that. Someone want to respond to the challenges of finding a school?
Are you talking about Chloe's essay?
Yes, I am, Sarah. Yeah.
Chloe Daly writes about finding a school, and to somebody with a child who has autism and is deaf, it seems like it would be really easy to find a school that you could get a wheelchair into. Like, that doesn't seem like such a big problem. Mm-hmm. But the truth of the matter is it's a huge problem. Mm-hmm. It's very expensive for some schools to do things like install elevators in a 1920s building that... Mm-hmm. Is an historical landmark. So there are so many complications dealing with even things that seem like, didn't we solve this problem in 1972? Mm-hmm. I mean, a wheelchair, really? And frankly, middle school is a nightmare. I mean, I'm sure it's not true everywhere, but, you know, I got my kid placed in the right program in middle school because the teacher pinched him and left a bruise on his neck.
Wow.
I mean, you know, that... Yeah.
Shannon,
you
write in your essay, as I recall, about school. And as I recall, at one point you write the sentence, I hate this school.
I hated that school.
Yeah.
I still hate that school. I'm actually thinking about that school. It makes me choke up because a parent recently at the same school that we left behind in kindergarten, my son is now in third grade, apparently recently stood up and said that she had a school board budget meeting and said that she couldn't believe that our kids were taking money from her kids. You know? So it's not just the schools. I mean, it's very difficult to find a placement for our children. Her son has been through many schools. Mm-hmm. My son went through three schools in 1 year once. He's now in a fantastic school, and we're very grateful for it. It's the right place for him. They were very fortunate in that we have a curriculum supervisor who comes in independently and helps manage his curriculum and works with the teacher as a team. Again, you know, we are the lucky ones that you're seeing right here. There are so many kids who just get shuffled through.
Shelley in San Diego has a question for the three of you. Shelley, go ahead.
Thanks for putting this out there. I really appreciate all the effort that you do. And I have a question. I live in the affluent part of San Diego called La Jolla. I actually had a caseworker come to my home and say, why do you ask for so much? I have people on my caseload that don't even have food in their refrigerator. What are you doing? Why are you taking from people who really need? So I want to find out, how do I get respite or ABA or speech or OT or all these things? How do I find out really what's available to me? And then how do I get it without this prejudice from my caseworker?
That is so unprofessional.
Yeah, you need to ask for a new caseworker.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry.
Matter.
That's my brother's a social worker in Orange County, and he encounters the same thing. And he has said, I feel like sometimes I walk in he's like, you can tell the difference between people who are taking advantage of the system and people who are just accessing their resources. And clearly, it sounds, I'm guessing, you're just trying to access your resources.
Jennifer, I want to key in on the first thing you said, which is you need to ask for another social worker. As part of what people need to be able to do is just say that sentence, to be assertive about what they need.
Assertion is number one.
We had a caseworker that was so blasé and did absolutely nothing and caused us a tremendous amount of personal cost. She didn't put in Jack's forms for Medi-Cal, and we had to pay for a whole bunch of stuff. My husband was unemployed at the time, or between jobs, whatever. Cobra was... So basically, I called, and I asked for the officer of the day, and I said, I need a new social worker. I can never speak to that woman again. Hmm. And I did. I got one.
Sherry in Daly City. Oh, Sarah, go ahead. Go ahead with the response.
The other thing I would like to say is that actually you just do have to deal with that a lot. Because to get the other social worker, you have to go through the bad one. And you just hear that sort of, you just encounter prejudice a lot as mm-hmm. the parent of a disabled child. It's just reality.
That's true, but you do.
It doesn't
have to
mean
be
you
able
should accept it. You shouldn't accept it. But you will encounter it. It just happens.
Sherry in Daly City is online with a question. Sherry, go ahead.
Well, it's really a comment. I spent about 10 years within the San Mateo County Office of Education for Special Needs Children, working as a substitute teacher. So I spent a lot of time in a lot of different classrooms with children of different ages with different challenges, but mostly children with autism, from extremely autistic to very mild autism. And one of the most important things that came across for me was that the misplacement of children. Now, I've just recently heard the parents speaking about that, and it's so crucial for parents to advocate for their kids from as early an age as possible. If they feel, from my perspective, the parents are the ones that know what's going on with their child. And so if they get any sense that their child is in the wrong educational setting, they need to speak up and push to get them changed right away, because I have seen incredible changes in children just by moving from one classroom to the next.
Sherry, let me hold you there, because we're just out of time, and I want to get a brief last comment on what you'd like people to be thinking about as this show comes to a conclusion. Jennifer, what's the lesson, I guess, that you'd like everyone to remember and to think about?
No pressure or anything. I just think that we want a place where people think about more than just themselves. And so without being judgmental, somehow offering a hand or a smile, even just a smile, is more helpful than...
Yeah. And also, my son is a 9-year-old boy. He may act funny. He may look funny. He's a 9-year-old boy. Please just see that. Don't see his disability. See him. He's beautiful. He's amazing, you know.
Shannon DeRosa, along with Jennifer Byde Myers and Sarah Talbot, will all be talking about their book tonight at the Modern Times bookstore at Valencia and 20th Street in San Francisco. That's tonight at 7. Tomorrow, they'll be at the Pegasus bookstore. That's the Pegasus on Shattuck Avenue, by the way. That's where that Pegasus location is, Shattuck Avenue in Berkeley, at 7:30. That's tomorrow. Sarah Talbot, Jennifer Byde Myers, and Shannon DeRosa will all be a part of that. Thanks all very much for being part
Thank
of our program
much.
Today.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lorberg, and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor, Dan Zoll. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.